We're going to spend our time today trying to unpack these six or seven verses that the lectionary has given us from Galatians. But first, I need to take you on an imaginative journey. Guess where? To Jerusalem again. And try and help us to think a bit harder about what Paul might have meant by law from which we need to be freed. When I imagine Jerusalem, I'm not just picturing buildings and landscapes, but people. And there's a wonderful diversity of people. And they're sort of dressed in all sorts of distinctive ways according to their faith traditions. So you're not the sort of homogenous jeans and t-shirts everywhere, but all sorts of robes and, all sorts. It's awash with religious identity dressing. Perhaps those who stand out most are Christian priests, monks and nuns, Orthodox Jewish men and Muslim women. But actually there are other identifiers that are a bit more subtle as well. Incidentally, I saw very few Muslim women wearing the full niqab or burqa. One guide told us actually that the ones who do are usually British tourists, which I thought was an interesting comment. But it is interesting, but you have to keep your wits about you when you go to visit holy places, whether churches, mosques, synagogues, or whatever. Because each one has got a different set of rules, how you are respectful in the place, what needs to be covered, and what can be left uncovered. I came to the conclusion that you need to think head, shoulders, knees, toes, because one or other will have a rule about it. A Jewish guide explained the differences amongst the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews we saw around us in the streets, how their different dress codes were ultimately different interpretations of the Torah, the Old Testament law, and it would lead to variations in, for example, tassels on clothing or hair, whether it's cut or uncut, and even design of hat. The guide said Judaism is a very contested faith. The old cliche of two rabbis and three opinions holds true. But unlike Christians, they don't argue over doctrine. He said the rabbis all agree about their beliefs. What they debate is practice, the rules about what you should do, including how you should dress. And these things they argue about endlessly. And I guess the people who accept one set of answers that one rabbi or one group of rabbis are giving, they then form a group, often identifiable by their clothing, by the times of prayer, by certain other practices. And belonging to that group becomes and remains a very important thing for their own identity. Now, I think it's these sort of rules that Paul is talking about in his passage, in the letter to the Galatians, when he's talking about the law. Not quite the same as the modern day ones, because rabbinic Judaism is different from ancient Judaism, but it is those practices to do with sacrifices, to do with what you can and can't eat, what you can and can't do on the Sabbath, and above all about circumcision. Those were practices there to, and they're part of the Old Testament, to define the Jewish people, to give them this sense of being set apart from the other nations, how they saw themselves as set apart for God. Paul is not putting these down. He's not saying they're wrong or misguided or anything else. He's got great respect for the people and the law. Nevertheless, he does here talk about the law as a form of imprisonment, which seems quite a strong phrase, except I think it's kind of a protective custody. Actually, I found this quite interesting, although it's a bit of a sideline, but the word he's using is possibly best put into English as babysitter, which gives a whole different set of images, because obviously, and I know there are lots of expert babysitters here, at least very experienced ones, and there to give love, care, protection, reassurance for children when their parents aren't there. But I guess from a child's point of view, a child who's growing to independence and wanting their own space and so on, a babysitter can be a bit like a jailer. You know, you've got to stay there, you've got to do this, that and the other. And a babysitter is there to be tested out. Can I push these rules a little bit? Can I have the boundaries more where I like them rather than where parents want them? Until, of course, a day when the babysitter's no longer needed, they're there for a time. The child will grow beyond having a babysitter, will be able eventually to look after themselves. And just on the further sideline, if you can't find babysitter in the passage anywhere, it's the nature of the English translation that there's a Greek word, those are interesting Greek words, it's paedagogos, from which we get pedagogue, I guess, but educationalist. But it was really a slave who would be given the job of supervising children, including taking them to school, making sure they didn't get, well, both for their protection and making sure they didn't get distracted on the way. So maybe babysitter is our nearest equivalent. Anyway, what Paul is accusing his readers of is of going back to their babysitters once they've grown up. Saying the law, the Jewish law, those customs that we've been talking about, were a bit like the babysitter, the paedagogos, for the whole people of Israel. It's given to protect them from falling into moral harm, to guide them in right ways, and to prepare them for adult life. That adult life has now arrived through Jesus Christ, his life, death, and resurrection. Because of Jesus' faithfulness to God, we can put our faith in him and live his way, then there's no need to worry about fulfilling the different stipulations of the law. You are free. See, you don't need the law as a babysitter any longer. But some of these people, so he's writing to Christians, probably of Jewish background, who have turned back, he's saying. They've started wanting Christ and the law as well. And they're telling other people to do the same. They've gone back to their old ways, their babysitters. Why would they do that? Well, I can only think that by this of obeying laws, partly they're deep within them, they've been brought up with them. But the point of the law is that they confirm their identity and thereby they belong to the group. And they don't feel that they can move on from that. excuse me. Today we know very much in the news issues about group identities in politics and society as well as in religion. And there's maybe an increasing sense of holding on to these identities that are precious to us. And it seems to me people get very defensive about the smallest of things, maybe overreact to the slightest criticism. And it's because they feel who they are, their identity is under attack. Such defensiveness surely is a sign of immaturity. And then there's this business that increasingly today we seem to only associate with like-minded people, those who belong to the same small group. And again, that must be a sense of insecurity that we can't take different opinions or approaches. There's this reduction that we seem to get all the time that reduces everyone to either us or them, dividing up humanity as those who are different from ourselves. And this definition can be by race or religion or nationality, class, wealth, gender, politics, anything. Seems to me we must resist it and resist it strongly, affirming with St. Paul that there is no Jew nor Greek, no slave nor free, no male nor female. We could add a whole list more. No old nor young, we might say. Because those are often taken as identifiers. Church-wise, no Catholic nor Protestant, nor church or chapel, whatever. In the country, no British and foreign, perhaps. Or in politics, no Brexiteer nor Remainer, or whatever else seems to divide people today. And of course, doesn't mean these things don't exist. I'm not wishing them out of existence. It's about seeing each person as an individual, a whole and rounded individual, and valuing and enjoying one another as part of the same community. As Paul's answer to this disintegration by identity is not about homogenization, it's not making everyone the same. It's actually something much simpler than that. It's simply recognizing you're all part of one family. That's God's family. What greater privilege could there be than that? Because God's family is the King of Kings, the ultimate royal family. And I was thinking about with our royal family, whenever there's a new child born in the family, in the royal family, if the papers are to believe, we all sit there imagining what it would be like to be brought up a royal, living in those great palaces with servants at the beck and call, or negatively thinking about being constantly in the public eye. But the thing is, whether you'd like it or not, you would always belong. Whether you lived in the palace or in the cottage, whether you, wore the right hat for Ascot or not, you'd still be part of the family, you'd belong. And that's what Paul is saying about freedom from the law that is establishing, holding identities. You don't have to prove yourself by meeting other people's standards or criteria. You believe, so you belong. Belonging in God's family is what matters to knowing who you are. The image he uses is clothing again. You are clothed with Christ. Whatever other clothes you may choose to wear, but religious garb is strictly optional because your identity is in Christ. And that is what brings freedom. There's freedom to enjoy and benefit from customs and traditions, old and new, from anywhere in the world. Just don't be precious about them. There's freedom to invest in love for God and neighbour, doing it the way that works for you, in your circumstance, your personality, your gifts, your availability, however, but love. There's freedom to flourish as a child of God. You don't have to conform to expectations or be forced into particular ways of doing and being. All that is a tremendous freedom, a freedom to enjoy and to celebrate. Freedom that stands out as distinctive in a world that seems set on retreating back to its babysitter. So walk tall and free as children of God.